Addiction never affects just the addict. It affects all of us. Recovering from addiction and alcoholism is also a life-changing battle for families dealing with a loved one's addiction. Numerous programs support addicts as they reclaim their lives, while their families face their own challenges without the same guidance. You're listening to Voices in Courage with K.L. Wells, where we transform the lives of the families and loved ones of addicts and alcoholics from surviving to thriving in the midst of chaos. Tune in as we highlight vulnerable stories of families who have addicted relatives and friends and learn how they have dealt with the challenges of isolation, desperation, and shame. If you are seeking ways to live your best life, then we welcome you into this safe space. Be a part of change today with your host, K.L. Wells.
I have been super excited about having this conversation with you, Sparkle, today. So everybody that's going to be listening to this, I think, is going to be really well served, because on the other side of the equation, the loved ones' side of the equation, it's like we're constantly trying to figure out what's a healthy way to support and love someone that we care so deeply about in the midst of when they're dealing with their own addiction. They're not in recovery. They're still in it. And so if you would just give us a little bit, you know, background in your story, and then, you know, this is going to just be a conversation really that I really honestly believe will serve so many people. So
wonderful. Well, thank you for having me. I'm really excited about this conversation too. And
great.
And nervous and anxious, but that's fine. It is what it is. Interestingly, this morning, as I was sort of spinning in anxiety, I was like, I'm going to pull a tarot card just to see what sort of guidance my soul and spirit can send me through tarot. And I pulled the Justice card, which is, you know, part of the major arcana, which are all about like the major life lessons. Mm-hmm. And justice is really about sort of the rational decision-making and accountability and responsibility, which was fascinating to me because I was spinning the emotion, and justice is all about rational and sort of stepping back from the emotion. And it's like, oh, okay, that's an interesting message, but that's not really answering your question. So background is I grew up in the biggest little city in the world, also known as Reno, sort of medium-sized, a large town, small city, at the time, fairly conservative and not really a good place for people who are different. And so as a queer kid in Reno, coming to grips with who I was, who I am, there just wasn't a lot of opportunity to really see that reflected anywhere in that environment. And there just wasn't anything, you know, it's a very adult town. And so for teens and kids, there just isn't opportunity. Mm-hmm. And this was also the height of the HIV epidemic as that began to hit. And so the messages I was receiving broadly from society was, you know, this is God's punishment on the gays, that I didn't deserve to be there, be alive, etc. And so lots of things got internalized. I started using meth at about, I think, 16, and used for about 6 years until I was 22, at which point I did a geographic intervention on myself. I had sort of recognized at some point this was not what I wanted or who I wanted to be. And I saw people who were 10 years older than me who were still in the throes of their meth addictions. And I was like, ooh, that's messy. I don't want that, right? And so I plucked myself out of Reno and moved up to Washington to sort of restart my life and sort of let go of that. So that span of 6 years, though, was the end of high school, the beginning of college, and also in that really important time for the growing and development of the brain. And so, yay me, I rewired my brain early from that. So that's something I've had to deal with for the rest of my life is how I rewired my brain. And I didn't actually realize that for about 20 years until I was like, oh, this is interesting, and started tracing it back and being like, oh, okay. Wow. Now some of my coping mechanisms or the ways in which I'm making my way through the world are in response to having rewired my brain, and they're functional in that sense. But it was interesting to sort of tie that back and realize like, oh yeah, I sort of screwed myself. I mean, on the one hand, I screwed myself. On the other hand, I look back and I'm like, I wouldn't actually change anything, because who I am today is in large part based, you know, due to what I went through. So, you know, I have, in terms of family structure, my parents are still together. They were together then, and it was rocky, sort of the peak of my dad's alcoholism. And so there was a lot of family stuff going on around that. I have an older sister who's 2 years older, and sort of right around the same time that I started using, dad's alcoholism was coming to a head. She went off to college. Right. And so there was a sense of abandonment for me of like, you know, my older sister's gone out of the house, leaving me to deal with this, everything falling apart kind of thing. So they didn't know at the time that I was using. They didn't find out. Well, my sister may have found out first, maybe 10 years later, but it was probably 15 years later.
Wow.
That they officially found out. Funny story about that. We were at this big family reunion in Sun River. And so, you know, it's my mom's extended family. And so there's like 25 people. It's late afternoon. We're all sitting around in the backyard outside drinking sangria. And, you know, I had a lot of sangria, and mom asked a very pointed question, and I responded with an affirmative. And then it was like, realizing like it's me and mom sitting there talking to each other, and the whole family is just surrounding us, listening to this story.
Okay.
And it was like, oh, okay. And some of them have since forgot it and then refound out later when I would post something like about the anniversary of coming off meth or whatever. But that was, it was an interesting way to disclose, as it were.
Yeah.
And then we had to deal with, you know, all of the feelings that came up for the mom and dad around, well, the first response was, well, that explains a whole lot of things, you know, and then working through the, like, what did I do? Was it my fault? You know, from my mom of like, what could I have done differently or this or that? And so me doing lots of work with her around, let that go. Wasn't you, you know, et cetera. So we had to start doing that kind of work. So we had a very rocky, rocky relationship, mom and I. Well, separating dad and mom. Mom and I had a really rocky relationship for a long time until, I don't know, maybe 10, 12 years ago, when I was like, it's time for us to have an adult friendship separate from family, separate from the holidays, right? So I would see her in the holidays and we'd get 2 minutes here, 5 minutes there, 3 minutes there, and just didn't have the opportunity to just dive deep with each other.
Right.
And so I invited her up to Seattle for a weekend, and she came up for a long weekend, and we had an amazing time. And so then every year since then, except during the pandemic, we spent a long weekend, either late winter, early spring, where we'll fly somewhere, meet, and just hang out, just the two of us, and talk and eat and shop and walk and talk, you know, and so have rebuilt a relationship since then. And, you know, so that's been a good thing, because she carried a lot of burden around that once she found out, and carried a lot of burden around how rough it was when I was, you know, coming of age.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, well, then who was aware at the time? It was just friends?
Yeah. I think just the friends who I was using with. You know, I was hiding it. You know, I was, I remember distinctly at one, like, high school assembly, the principal getting up and just talking about how wonderful it was that there was not a drug problem at our high school. And I was like, you're right. Because I walked across the street to use meth. So I wasn't actually at the school. I was like high as a kite during this assembly. And I'm just like, y'all are clueless. But I feel like I had a lot of privilege, because I ended up, I mean, I want to, you know, I don't want this to sound too like haughty or whatever, but I was one of those who's like, my smartness doesn't match the school system. Right. And so that school was a game. Like, what's the minimum I can do to get the passing grades to be able to satisfy everybody?
Right.
While I'm still high as a kite.
Yeah.
And I ended up graduating fifth in my class, despite being, you know, a meth addict. Mm-hmm. And then I, you know, took a gap year, went to school, University of Nevada on a full ride scholarship, mm-hmm. which, you know, I was able to get while in the throes of meth addiction.
Right.
I came to the system. Mm-hmm. And so 2 years in, meth use was increasing, attendance in class was decreasing, grades started to plummet. And I was like, I'm out. Mm-hmm. I'm done. This is not working for me. Mm-hmm. And so I gave up my full ride, which, mm-hmm. you know, the parents weren't too happy about, but I was mm-hmm. like, I can't do that. It's not working. And that was shortly before I left and mm-hmm. moved away. But I was just like, I can't, this is not a game I want to play anymore. It's not working.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So.
And so in the throes of that, what I'm thinking about is the shame and the secrets and the silence that goes with all of this and the lying and the deception. And I think that, you know, for a parent or somebody who loves somebody who's in the throes of their active addiction, that's one of the hardest things to kind of get, wrap your head around. And what you spoke to earlier in terms of really, really understanding that your brain has just been hijacked and then reconfigured in a way that we don't know you anymore. And so if you would kind of speak to those elements of being in it so that people who, you know, haven't had this experience, but love somebody who's in it, they have a better window in into understanding what actually is really kind of going on.
Yeah. Well, I think what you're hitting on is a difference in perception, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So on the outside, what you perceive as lies and deception and change on the inside is not that at all.
Okay. So say more.
I'm not lying to you. Mm-hmm. I'm surviving mm-hmm. and I'm figuring out how to feed the addiction.
Right.
So it's not deception. It's not lies. It's my survival mode and it's got nothing mm-hmm. to do with you.
Right. Right.
You're just a player.
Yeah.
Right. And so the part of what happens is that emotional attachment, that emotional, like, oh, your mom or your dad mm-hmm. or your family mm-hmm. shifts mm-hmm. to become, you're either a resource.
Yeah.
Or you're in the way mm-hmm. or both.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You know?
And yeah. So my relationship with you is, how do I get what I need? Mm-hmm. And if I can't, okay, moving on.
Next,
right? Mm-hmm. And so that's, I think, the piece of it is on the inside, it really, it's not a like active, I'm a lie to you. Mm-hmm. That's it. Mm-hmm. Yes, it is layered with shame, mm-hmm. right? Because there's a part of the brain or the part of the mm-hmm. soul who's like, I'm f-ing this up. Mm-hmm. I'm a mess. Mm-hmm. But wait, I'm going to get my next. Because that'll mm-hmm. quiet that little voice down.
I see. Okay.
Right. So that's there. And that sort of feeds like the how we interact because, you know, there's this, we really pick up on judgment really easily. Everybody does. Right. Mm-hmm. But when you're in the addiction, you pick up on it even more. Even the subtlest thing that you all don't intend as judgment, we pick up and interpret as that, or rather the addiction and the rewired brain interprets it as judgment. And so that adds another layer of like, I don't want to be judged because there's shame in it and there's shame in addiction. Right. And it's not to say like, I'm not trying to lay blame or anything. It just is, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, as we make our way through the world, one of the things that happens is we judge people mm-hmm. and people pick up on it, and people with addiction, we pick up on it even more.
Yeah. So there's a hypersensitivity.
Hypersensitivity. And so you could say hello and I'd be like, what are you, you're judging me. Like, why are you saying hello to me in that kind of tone or whatever? And you're just like, I'm just saying hi, mm-hmm. you know? And so, you know, going back to that rewired brain piece is like, mm-hmm. from the outside, you're interpreting things based on sort of like, quote unquote, normal brain progression or normal brain activity or sort of the norm. From the inside, it's a different norm. It's like mm-hmm. drug-addled norm, as it were. And so those two don't match, which leads to so much of the tension. So while you're like trying to logic it or be mm-hmm. like, well, this is that, that barrier in the middle is getting in the way of interpretation. Because on my side, I'm like, oh, it's totally rational that I'm going to go ask mom for $500 out of the blue when I haven't talked to her for 2 weeks.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I say, hi, give me money. Mm-hmm. That's perfectly rational and reasonable because I'm like, I need $500 because either I got to pay for some bill or, you know, I need some more meth or whatever. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. From your side, you're like, what the hell? I haven't seen you for 2 weeks and suddenly you appear and all you say is, hi, give me money. Mm-hmm. That's not rational. Mm-hmm. Right. And so that filter in the middle mm-hmm. from both yeah. sides is getting in the way, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we've been through it so many times, you know, and yeah. So my reaction to it is it's somewhat annoying. And at the same time, even when I'm in that, like, okay, this is somewhat annoying, I am remembering that he's in survival mode and that he will do anything to make sure that he has whatever dollars that he needs in order to get the next high. Right. And I hadn't quite thought about it as clinically as it sounded when you said, you know, I'm not really mom, I'm just a resource. Mm-hmm. And either the resource is going to help from his perspective or it's not. And if it's not, then next. And so it feels like that's why, I guess this is how it's appearing to me, is that's why your world gets smaller and smaller and smaller, is because generally speaking, like me, I'm not going to give Sam money. Patty's not going to give Sam money. Courtney is not going to give Sam money. And so his world is shrinking, shrinking, shrinking in terms of who's going to continue to give him money to feed mm-hmm. the addiction. And so then left with like nobody surrounding him as a resource that loves him, he's turning to, you know, other things that are illegal and so not who he really is. And so trying to hold that in the same space as a mom of who he is in addiction mode is just in survival mode. And whatever he's doing doesn't at all square up with who I know him to be when he's clean.
Right.
So
no, you're right, because it's the different perspective, like that whole thing about family, love, network of support that gets erased mm-hmm. or not erased, but buried mm-hmm. under this other piece, which is mm-hmm. how am I going to get through this? How am I going to survive? And right. if you can't help me, I don't care. It doesn't matter who you are.
Right.
And that's the addiction talking, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's the like, mm-hmm. okay, you look like mom, but really...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're a pocketbook, a wallet. Mm-hmm. And if the wallet's empty, I got to find a different one. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's, I think, that hard part too is the actions that you all take to try and love and support. Mm-hmm. We don't interpret it in that mm-hmm. way. Mm-hmm. It's transactional, mm-hmm. right? Where on the outside, mm-hmm. for your side, mm-hmm. it's relational, mm-hmm. right? On the inside, it's transactional. If that makes sense, and those don't mesh very well.
Right, right. Yeah. So, I mean, this is really so helpful, you know, given where we are currently. You know, Sam is in mm-hmm. The throes at this point, really down a deep, dark hole. And we're trying to figure out how to navigate this in a way that we stay sane mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And still hold the space for him to hopefully at some point emerge out the other side. So that we can be present for him when and if he gets back to relational.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And to be honest, the sad truth is there's nothing you can do mm-hmm. that will help that along. Mm-hmm. Right? That's the really hard part about it mm-hmm, is right. he's got to get there himself. We have to get there ourselves mm-hmm. and come to that spot where we can begin to switch that back to relational. And so in the meantime, it's like, well, what do we do? Mm-hmm. How do we stay loving and supportive mm-hmm. when it's not being interpreted that way mm-hmm. or doesn't seem to matter?
If, right.
You know, and I'm, you know, I was thinking this about this since you asked me to do this interview of, you know, the question you posed was, what are the top three things that made you feel loved and supported while mm-hmm. in addiction? Mm-hmm. And the answer is, there isn't anything. Mm-hmm. Which is not to say that there aren't things you can do or are doing. Mm-hmm. But going back to this other piece is mm-hmm. love and support is relational.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Addiction is transactional.
Right, right.
And yeah. so when you're doing things like setting boundaries, mm-hmm. which are a wonderfully loving thing to do, mm-hmm. relationally, mm-hmm. transactionally, mm-hmm. empty wallet, moving on. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That, yeah. So
hard part.
But what I would say is that distinction that you have just described for me personally gives me such clarity right. and gives me more permission to just hold the space for him and then allow, really turn it over and surrender to mm-hmm. whatever this journey is of his. And we have no idea, you know, whether he's going to come out the other side of this, you know, whether he'll overdose, you know, whether he'll, you know, there's all the possibilities. But this distinction of relational on our side of the equation versus transactional on the addict or alcoholic side of the equation, that this is the first time I've heard this. Like in all the stuff I've read, all the movies I've watched, and all the people that I've heard, this clarity had not shown up until this moment. So,
interesting.
Yes, absolutely. Fascinating. I mean, certainly the brain science piece of it, yes. And understanding that his brain's been hijacked and rewired and so on and so forth. But I hadn't thought about it through the lens of transactional resource, no more money, next.
Yeah.
That was not how I had it framed in my head.
Yeah.
So that, Sparkle, is a huge gift.
Thank you. I'll be honest, I hadn't really thought about it in that way until this morning when I started talking about it. So it's a gift from spirit and the universe of mm-hmm. this is what needs to come out and mm-hmm. come through mm-hmm. today. And I just, you know, I just kept thinking of like, maybe then this might be the anxiety that I was feeling is that mm-hmm. you asked a wonderful, wonderful question of like, you know, what made you feel loved and supported as a way to help folks who are loving and supporting people with addiction to mm-hmm. continue loving and supporting addiction. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I was like, I don't have an answer because there isn't one. Mm-hmm. And maybe, I think maybe that might have been some of the anxiety of like, okay, so I have to tell all these people who are listening.
Right. That the truth.
Doesn't really matter what you do. I'm still not feeling loved and supported because that's mm-hmm. not what it's about. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so the message is keep loving and supporting, mm-hmm. you know, holding your boundaries, holding space, continuing to love so that when they do come back out, mm-hmm. you're there mm-hmm. and you still love them, mm-hmm. you know, and really like working on that judgment thing of paying attention to how judgment may creep in unintentionally, mm-hmm. you know, because that's what folks pick up on. And so mm-hmm. I think I was just like, oh my gosh, you know, they want the answers. And I'm like, yeah, there isn't one. Sorry.
Well, you know, as you're talking, I'm thinking it's like, so when he would call up until, you know, about 4 or 5 days ago, it's like, what do you talk about? I mean, I'm totally happy. Well, what do you talk about? Cause our thing is you need to get to rehab. And it's not like I'm going to say, so what have you been up to? You know, well, I mean, I do, but I realize there's a game being played here. And so it feels weird, I would say, to know that we're just playing a game here until you ask me for money.
Right.
So you just keep playing the game?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the answer is, you know, it's a game. He mm-hmm. knows it's a game. Mm-hmm. And there isn't really a way around it until mm-hmm. he makes the decision mm-hmm. to say, I'm coming back out of this mm-hmm. at this point. Right. Because the stuff you really want to say, which is, you know, get your shit together, mm-hmm. get your ass to rehab, mm-hmm. be a responsible adult, mm-hmm. you know, we know it.
Yeah. Yeah.
We know it. Mm-hmm. And then being reminded of it then adds to the shame,
right?
The guilt, the desire to like, let's cut this off because there's another reminder of that part of the brain that's still like cognizant of what's happening. There's that reminder, and I don't want that because that's not where I'm at.
Right.
You know, and so as hard as it is to not do that, you know, I think it's,
Wow. Okay. So it is really learning to rewrite the script on the other side of being a loved one who cares about somebody. And I mean, we're, so there's so many things going on in my head right now.
Sure.
And I think we have it easier because we're not in the same state. And so he doesn't live here. He doesn't live with us and all of that. So what?
Doesn't show up at the door.
Correct. Exactly. So in some ways we have it so much easier. Like I can wrap my head around this conversation and then show up differently next time based on this conversation, because I'm going to have time and space to practice and get it in, you know, in kind of ingrained in my thinking as best I can. And to be able to legitimately say, so how are you doing? You know, what's going on? And be prepared. Cause I still think, you know, for me personally, it's the struggle of just wanting to do something that will turn the tide and being told that there really is nothing we can do to turn the tide. And so, okay, so then what can I do that is serving from afar?
Right. Well, what I would say is there's his addiction and he's in that and he's got to do it and he has to turn the tide. And then there's, I don't want to say your addiction, but there's your relationship to it, to his addiction. That's where you have control, right? That's where you have things to do. And so when you think about, you know, what can you do to turn the tide? It's not what can you do to turn his tide, because that's
right.
What can you do to turn your tide?
Yes.
You know, and I think that's a really good reminder too, to see like, okay, I can't change that or that behavior. I can change my relationship to it, my understanding of it, how I respond to it and that sort of thing. And prepare to hold the space and prepare for the return, as it were. That's where you've got the control. That's where you've got the voice. That's where you've got things that you can do. So, you know, I think it's like taking that feeling of helplessness, letting that go, because recognizing, you know, this is, you know, everything you read about addiction, et cetera, is like, they've got to do it themselves. Right. They, you know, they've got to figure it out, and maybe an intervention will work or whatever. But really what it comes down to is, are they going to do it? So taking that and being like, okay, if I can't do anything there, where can I?
Right. Right.
And none of us are helpless in our own lives, right?
Correct. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, and I will say, I mean, because the industry of addiction is so messy, and I'm being kind, you're spot on in terms of the part that we can control is ourselves, obviously. But it is definitely rewriting what that looks like, sounds like, and feels like. And I know what I was thinking was, you had said something like, you know, generally speaking, when you read books or watch movies or whatever, they're talking about this. Well, actually, they're really not in some ways. I mean, you know, I mean, one of the books I read pretty early on when we realized Sam was in addiction was Beautiful Boy. And my God, I mean, that dad was so sucked into finding his son all the time and throwing him in rehab and doing an intervention and all the things to fix him. And I was like, okay, I don't want to be doing that, but what do I do? You know? And so there's a lot of mixed messages out there, which is another reason why this conversation is so critically important for those of us who love people to understand what's actually really going on.
Yeah. Well, I think they did make a movie out of that book, Beautiful Boy, and I just watched it a few days ago and was like, why did I do that? That was a tough one. What that reminds me of is the cultural messages we get are that we can fix people. We can fix other people. Like broadly, that's the overarching narrative is we can fix you. I can fix you. You can fix me. I can fix whoever. And we just can't, right? That's just not possible. Because the reality is, y'all don't know what this is about.
Right.
Where it started, what influenced it. And so it's really easy to take ownership, as it were, to say, oh, this is my fault. I'm a parent. Right. I should have done blah, 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 or I could have this or that or whatever. But you don't know. You just don't. And so I would say, one, yes, take accountability and responsibility for role you actually played, which may or not may not be anything. Right. It could be, oh, I was this way and that had an influence. Or it could be like, I was the best mom in the world and still. Right. So taking accountability and responsibility for self and recognizing that the roots of this for the other person, for us, you'll never really know, you know? So I can say, yeah, I had it was a rough time because, you know, alcoholism in the family, you know, but I think more broadly for me, it was really like these broader messages that were coming.
Right.
Around identity and coming at the, you know, as it in the HIV epidemic where it was and that sort of stuff. So I think those were the roots and they got layered by like dad stuff with alcoholism, et cetera, but that wasn't the cause, you know, that helped. But, and then that's dad's journey to take ownership and responsibility of, of that, you know, and we're not at a place where we can have a really non-judgmental, non-emotional conversation about that because he hasn't done his work and that's fine, you know.
Yeah.
That's not on me.
Yeah.
I can recognize like, oh, this had an influence on that because that exacerbated that or whatever. But the roots, like what's going on in the core, it could also be like, soul's still working on a lesson from three lifetimes ago that has absolutely nothing to do with you. And you just happen to be
the mom
off the ride.
Right.
As it were. So, I mean, the point is really like, and I don't mean to be lighthearted about this, but it's just like, you just don't know. And so taking ownership of it is pointless because it's like, it's not about you all in that sense. And, and that's hard too, because you want to do your own stuff and moms particularly like to take ownership of how their children have become in the world and internalize and personalize it in ways that are not helpful for you or for the kid really, but in this conversation for you. And so as those play out, again, in that relational transactional thing,
Yeah.
You're coming from this space of like, I nurtured you, you know, I gave birth to you, I nurtured you, I wanted to create a beautiful human being. And then this happened. And what am I taking? Like, how did I fail? Right. Bump that against the transactional. Right. And the failure from this side is your wallet's empty.
Right.
And it's not attached to any of that other stuff.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Later coming out, then you can have conversations, but in that place, it just isn't, it's not helpful or useful.
Yeah, totally. That totally makes sense. And I am curious because I don't identify with feeling like I failed as a mom. I do identify with wanting him to be well. I don't identify with, quote, fixing him necessarily either, other than I want him to be well, which in the way that I think about this is, particularly since he's been in rehab and relapsed so many times and has not been able to stop like you did, you know, a relocation and then stop using, that has not been his story so far. So, and even having said that, I know there are a lot of parents that fix them is the first thing, and then everything will be fine. And then if they, you know, dare to even remotely think, what did I do? Then you kind of go down that rabbit hole too. And that's crazy making. So
also the messages that we get from society is like, you know, you as parents are responsible for everything that your kid does.
Yes.
And who they are in the world. Mm-hmm. Like that's the message, the narrative, right? And so that's why it's so easy to go down that rabbit hole and fall into that, because that is the common, like, well, yeah, of course it's your fault and your responsibility when it's not, but that's countercultural, as it were.
It definitely is countercultural. And so, you know, one of the huge things surrounding this that we touched on a little earlier is, you know, the shame and the silence and the secrets. And we live in a culture that encourages all of that. And so to be countercultural, to, you know, do what we're doing right now, to have a real and raw conversation about both sides of this equation and to tell the truth about it and to have dropped the shame around all of this and to drop the secrets around this and to drop the silence around this so that we can really understand, you know, the way that I frame this is the breakdown is taking place so the breakthrough can happen. And addiction and alcoholism and all these things are all part of the breakdown humanitarian wise so that we can actually elevate. That's how I frame it.
Yeah. I do want to say I have not let go of the shame. I'm holding it over here right now and doing this anyway, but it's still there. It's still there. And, you know, I also want to acknowledge too, that my journey is very different than most in that I was able to quit. And so it's been 28 years, I guess, since I've used. And there are times when I still want to, but it's a pretty rare thing for somebody to be able to quit by themselves.
Right.
Not go through some kind of program and just do it in that way. And so I just want to acknowledge that too, that that piece of my story is not very common.
Right.
So.
Well, and I mean, just within the context of the statistics, it's like a unicorn because the statistics are so dismal. I mean, 2% reach out for help. And out of that 2%, basically 2% actually survive. And so the fact that you did it without, you know, a rehab or a program or whatever that is, I mean, such a unicorn. At the same time, still the wisdom that you're sharing relative to your side of the equation and your side of the disease is invaluable for those of us who don't understand it to better understand and to better be prepared for letting go of our own shit and rewriting our own stories. And if we have shame or guilt or judgment of ourselves around this, is to just drop that so that.
But necessary. And, you know, I think too, it was probably 15 years after quitting before I was even willing or able to talk about it, you know? And so coming to a place where I can be raw and open and honest and vulnerable about it, you know, with someone who is not on this side of it, right? Like that's a journey to get to that, point for sure. And you, I mean, you know, I live now in a state of open vulnerability because I think that's so important for the world to have folks who are willing to talk about this stuff and be vulnerable.
Right.
But that's a learned, hard fought space to be from.
I mean, I don't understand it necessarily, obviously, through your lens and your journey. I understand it through my own, you know, having grown up with a mom who was addicted to prescription medications, a brother who was addicted to cocaine. You know, I married an alcoholic. So I have been, you know, on a lifelong journey myself around just understanding my walk in the world and who I am meant to be. And given all of this, you know, kind of like, hey, what's the calling that has emerged out of this, which is sure. how Voices in Courage got born.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think, you know, you and I have really kind of only known each other, what, about 4 years?
Mm-hmm.
And we, you know, we did a really deep, yes. intimate vision quest process for 9 months together, and where everything was up, and at least from, you know, everything was talked about, and we gave each other permission and love to be able to be who we both really are in yeah. all of this. And so what do I want to say is, so deeply appreciate the trust and the bond that has created this conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Likewise.
Yeah.
Likewise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I do want to also say, sort of contextually, about addiction
mm-hmm.
is the conversation, sort of the broader cultural conversation, is there are hard drugs or alcohol that people are addicted to.
Mm-hmm.
That's bad.
Mm-hmm.
But if you step back from that,
mm-hmm.
and think, humans for their entire existence have loved to alter their consciousness
mm-hmm.
through some kind of chemical means, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Fermented whatever,
mm-hmm.
coffee, chocolate,
mm-hmm.
sugar,
mm-hmm.
right? And all of those, like, you know, we say addiction mm-hmm. and what we're talking about is hard drugs, but the reality is, you know, my morning coffee,
mm-hmm.
don't get in the way of my morning
coffee. Right.
And I think, you know, as culture and society has gotten so much more complex and capitalism has had its long-term impacts, that we lose more people to that as mm-hmm. we get further and further away from the more natural ways of altering one's consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these chemical drugs that are out there that are really wreaking havoc are hugely problematic. And yet, culturally, we blame the individual.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right. And so it's not to say I am not responsible for my own addictions and my own mm-hmm. path in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And we can hold that and hold that mm-hmm. there is a broader cultural phenomenon happening that
mm-hmm. yes.
we are parts of. Right.
And, yes.
And I think that's really important to acknowledge, too,
mm-hmm.
particularly in this context of, you know, how do we on the outside support somebody on the inside of it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. And that whole blame, guilt, fault thing also mm-hmm. is mm-hmm. our society sets us up for failure.
Yes.
Right. And this is a place, an example of how that happens as well, that both leads people into these kinds of addictions. You know, if I hadn't grown up in a place that had nothing for young people to do and was mm-hmm. really not a good place for folks who are different.
Mm-hmm.
Would I have turned out different? I don't know, but mm-hmm. that was part of it. You know, the war on drugs, which I sort of became a meth addict in the middle of, you mm-hmm. know, early on, Reagan mm-hmm. and such, mm-hmm. that all is context and fodder for it. But mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if we've talked about this before, but there was a book that I read back in 96 called The Paradigm Conspiracy, and it has been by my bedside ever since. And it gives the larger purpose for me in all of this. It's the comparative contrast of cultural thinking. One is power over and control of, which we are steeped mm-hmm. in,
right,
compared to soul honoring. And the soul honoring example that they give is the Iroquois Confederacy, which was born out of the near annihilation of the Northeast tribes at that time, back in the 1500s, mm-hmm. because they were killing each other and they were on the precipice of wiping themselves out. And out of that, they flipped it to a soul honoring culture. And of course, you know, we invaded and flipped it back. And that context for me has given me a larger purpose
mm-hmm.
for all of this is, and I think about all the things that are crumbling and destructing right now that have been born out of power over and control of paradigm. And that my hope is that my role in flipping the script is what I'm up to at this point. is to help move humanity back towards a soul honoring culture.
Yeah.
Where a lot of this conversation that we're having right now is, these are all red flags. This isn't working from a spiritual perspective. But a lot of people don't even understand they're in a paradigm of thinking. And so don't even know that there's something to get out of, so to speak, from a way of thinking perspective. Although I will say there are more and more people that are having these conversations now and speaking right to this evolution of humanity away from power over and control of. But yeah, so that's how I frame it.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, in this context, it's important to think about how are we as individuals playing out those broader cultural things, no matter which side of this addiction coin we're on.
Right.
Or this addiction dynamic, as it were. Yeah. You know, we're talking really about parents and children or, you know, loved ones and working with loved ones. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important for us to recognize our part in that, those broader things as they play out, and not as an excuse to step away from accountability.
No, not at all.
Just as understanding, you know, and like, oh, if this is how I'm playing this out as the mother of someone who is addicted and in the throes of addiction, is that helping this situation at all or not?
Right.
And I think that requires some really sort of deep, rational honesty and vulnerability with oneself to be like, okay, am I further contributing to a dynamic that is harmful to both of us? Because, you know, you beating your relational head against the transactional brick wall isn't healthy for you, right? And isn't setting you up to be in a loving, open space to hold love out when they come back.
Right.
Right. And so being really, really direct and honest with oneself about how you're playing into this situation, helping or harming it, is going to be really, really helpful. And I can tell you on the other side, we do that all the time. Right. There's a little part of us in while we're in the middle of it that's doing it that we keep shushing up. But then that voice is what we're facing when we come out of it, right? On the return. And that spot where you don't want to contribute to that. You know, when we're coming back out, what we need is just hold. That's it. Just hold. Because we're facing that. Those demons and those voices and all of that are really loud at that point because we've been shushing them for a while. And so, you know, I think whatever you can do to not contribute to those voices on the return and just hold, that's like critical.
Right.
And, you know, what did I say earlier? 28 years and I'm still dealing with those voices. They're still very loud.
Right.
I mean, not quite as loud anymore, but
sure. Yeah.
Their way I can rearing up.
Yeah. I can see it. I mean, and the fact that, you know, your shame was still present for you in this conversation, I don't know that I would have thought that. And so again, I appreciate you, you know, being so vulnerable and open to, so that, you know, I certainly I can better understand the journey of all of this and that others can too. And, you know, and it isn't just about moms and dads, it's friends that are watching friends, you know, go through this. And anybody who's watching somebody go through this is, it's heartbreaking. It shatters the dreams, you know, that you held for the person that you love so much. And I, having been through the shattered dreams part of this, you know, and kind of giving it up to understand, like, I don't begin to know what his spiritual journey is.
Right.
And it's not my job to quote, no. And I, you know, so, and whatever it is that I think I know, I'm making it up anyway. So, but I'm going to make up a story that actually serves the planet. I know that much about myself. There's going to be a higher purpose in all of this.
Sure.
In his journey and certainly in mine. So.
I do want to just say though, for many folks who are going to watch this, they're not there yet. And that is totally okay.
Great.
Totally okay to work on the story that is the most healthy and helpful for yourself, mm-hmm. just start, right? Before you get to, like, you've done a lot of work to get to the point where you're like, I'm working for a healthier planet mm-hmm. and a higher purpose. And I also just feel like it's important to give people permission
yes.
to not do that. Mm-hmm. That serving their own higher purpose, their own selves' higher purpose, their own soul's higher purpose mm-hmm. is just as important.
Absolutely.
And helpful. And I also feel called to acknowledge that I too have been on your side of the equation with people I love.
Mm-hmm, I'm sure. Mm-hmm.
Which is also, you know, despite all of what I've talked about and knowing this, like still falling into frequent mm-hmm. common traps of like, what did I do wrong? And this and that, and how could I have done all that?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a journey for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So in addition to everything that you've said so far, is there one kind of driving pivotal message that you think is really important for those of us who are loved ones to hear, to understand, to think about things differently?
I mean, I think it goes back to what we've been talking about this whole time, which is mm-hmm. what that person needs, what the loved one needs is only hold space with love, mm-hmm. right? That's all the rest is extraneous mm-hmm. and challenging. And so it's not about doing anything. Mm-hmm. It's about mm-hmm. being mm-hmm. the highest purpose of a loved one, mm-hmm. the highest purpose of a mother, the mm-hmm. highest purpose of a father or a sister or a brother or a sibling or mm-hmm. a relative, you know, and really just, when you know, the urge to do, fine, but do for yourself. Mm-hmm. And not for them. Like doing for them means just being for them, if that makes mm-hmm. sense. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think that's what I would hold up as the hardest thing to do and probably the most important.
Oh my goodness. I think it goes counter to everything that we've been taught mm-hmm. is because we have been taught to be doing machines.
Right. Right.
And doing means changing it. And that is not what this is about.
Yeah. Everybody is on their own journey. Mm-hmm. Some are going to make it and some aren't, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, holding love for those who don't make it. Mm-hmm. It's just as important as holding love for those who do mm-hmm. or who are in it, you know, because again, we don't know what their soul's purpose is or their soul's journey is. And, right. and yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. So lots to think about, lots to think about, lots to be with, lots to allow to kind of marinate mm-hmm. and be too. With.
Hmm? Me too. For me too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I mean, the way that I think about this, Sparkle, is this is why we want to have these kinds of conversations with people, is because I won't be the same on the other side of this conversation.
Right.
And neither will you. And so there's so much power just in the conversation alone for both of us, mm-hmm. much less giving other people the opportunity to witness this conversation. Mm-hmm. And then they can choose to do with this whatever they choose to do.
Yeah.
But they have an opportunity to have a window in and witness a conversation that most people do not have
right.
or witness.
Yeah. Because I think, you know, the chances of me having this vulnerable and deep of a conversation with my mother mm-hmm. are about zero. The chances of you having this kind of deep, vulnerable conversation with Sam are about zero. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. And mm-hmm. so I think it's a gift of our journey together that we can mm-hmm. do the stand in.
Yes. Right? Yes. Yes.
And have this. So.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's a beautiful way to think about it. I mean, I would love to think that this kind of conversation would be possible with Sam, knowing, you know, full well that probably not, but I'm happy to have you stand in for him.
Likewise. Right back at you.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, well, I have a lot to think about. And I know this has been, you know, super rich and super deep, and will whoever's watching this will have a lot to think about too and marinate with, and hopefully they will have gained a nugget or two so that it helps in their own journey as a loved one dealing with people that we love. And we want to figure out how to navigate this.
Totally.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, maybe in a few months when we've marinated a little, maybe we can have a part two and go a little deeper, maybe. I don't know. Mm-hmm.
We'll see. Well, I would love to. And quite a few of the conversations I have had is we have done it a round two, because in the course of the conversation, we both shifted, or all three of us shifted or whatever. And I think about these things deeply after I've had these conversations. So I would love to have another conversation if you're open to that. So
I am. Indeed.
Fantastic. Okay, great. Yeah. Okay, good. Thank you. I don't even know that there are the words in the English language to say how deeply grateful I am for this conversation, but who you are.
Thank you.
You know, who you are in my life, and now who you are in other people's lives that we may not even know. So deep gratitude, my friend.
Thank you. Likewise for you as well.
Addiction never affects just the addict. It affects all of us. Recovering from addiction and alcoholism is also a life-changing battle for families dealing with a loved one's addiction. Numerous programs support addicts as they reclaim their lives, while their families face their own challenges without the same guidance. You're listening to Voices in Courage with K.L. Wells, where we transform the lives of the families and loved ones of addicts and alcoholics from surviving to thriving in the midst of chaos. Tune in as we highlight vulnerable stories of families who have addicted relatives and friends and learn how they have dealt with the challenges of isolation, desperation, and shame. If you are seeking ways to live your best life, then we welcome you into this safe space. Be a part of change today with your host, K.L. Wells.